This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Tennessee. Come along and join us as we visit with Lee Kennedy, who's a distiller and visionary. Tell us about your operation here.
Well, Tom, thanks for being here. I've been distilling since I was about 16, just dabbling in it. Had an uncle that distilled a little bit, showed me some of the ropes and found some archaic literature. In 2009, the state of Tennessee changed their laws for the first time since 1910. Before Prohibition, Tennessee had about 322 distilleries in it. Whiskey was a very predominant industry in the state. Prohibition kind of wrecked that. After Prohibition, only two distilleries came back, the ones that we know, the big boys. In 2009, our state legislature reversed the law regarding distillation, and the state opened up the rest of the counties to it. So yeah, I was barn distilling at the time. You know, it was a major passion of mine. I wasn't doing it professionally. So I always had this dream and started putting things on paper and everything checked out. So I actually started the process with my county in 2012. It took us 3 years of public hearings, but we got it approved. And then we started construction and we put our first barrel back in 2016, about May or April of 2016. It was really a four-year project that really started before that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it has been a long road, but we're finally here.
So a distiller is actually really a brewer of beer that doesn't know when to stop. Right?
We joke around. We say that brewers are quitters. We take the extra step, but you're exactly right. The definition of whiskey is a distilled beverage made from fermented grains. Mm-hmm. And as you know, fermented grains is beer. So our mash, we call it a distiller's beer, and we use it in all local grains and things like that.
Really interesting.
Yes, sir.
Talk to us about your sourcing of grains.
We try to keep everything as hyper-local as we can. You know, we make 25,000 gallons of whiskey here a year. Our big brother down the road makes about 125,000 gallons a day. So we're a very small batch distillery. We make a bourbon and a Tennessee whiskey primarily, which by federal law has to be at least 51% corn. We use 70% corn. That corn's grown on my farm up the road. The wheat comes from here in Williamson County, within 5 miles of the distillery. The rye and barley come from southern Kentucky. So we try to keep it as local as we can. Everything's non-GMO. You know, consumers are a lot more educated now than they used to be. So they're asking questions about base ingredients and things like that.
And what does yeast play in the equation?
Right. So, and you sound like you're pretty knowledgeable. In the brewing process that happens first, we use enzymes in the malt to separate the starch from the grain. And then what we're doing is converting that starch to sugar. The yeast consumes the sugar and as a byproduct produces alcohol. So our distiller's beer will be about 10% alcohol by volume when we're finished, or fermentation.
Are the nuances of an individual type of yeast less important in making whiskey versus beer?
So they're all a alcohol producing strain of yeast. A distiller's yeast tends to be, we want to get our mash as high as percentage as we can. So we want 10 to 12% alcohol by volume in our mash, where a brewer doesn't need to achieve that. So we get a lot of flavor components, profiles out of our yeast. Any kind of nutty flavors are usually contributed by yeast.
Is that a variable to your end product? So you can play around with your sourcing.
We used probably four or five different yeast strains when we started and settled on one. And they all give, like you said, that little nuance to the distillate and a little bit of flavor on the yeast strain. So that's an important factor. That's one of the effectors of flavor for sure.
Interesting.
Living organism. A lot of people don't realize fungus family. Yes. Yeah.
So it's interesting because it's such a minimalist process with very few ingredients.
Sure.
That each one is a big variable and critical.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, it's a very natural, you know, we were talking about brewers being quitters. You know, fermentation happens naturally in nature. It occurs naturally. Man-induced fermentations, you know, evidence shows 12,000 years ago, 9,000, 10,000 years ago, people have figured out that anything with fermentable sugars is fermentable, producing alcohol. So,
yeah.
And human beings have been, you know, kind of fascinated by that for thousands of years.
I remember really young, I had some apple cider, and I didn't pay attention, and it got better and better.
Exactly. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. End result, your boutique, small volume.
Yes.
most of it is produced for on-site distribution?
We will be producing in the next couple of years. Our Tennessee whiskey is fun. You're here right now. We're actually bottling Tennessee, our 40-year-old Tennessee whiskey right now. We just got our labels in yesterday. So we'll be releasing about 125,000 bottles per year in the next couple years.
And distribution to who?
We'll be a regional brand in the Southeast. You'll start to see us in Texas. We were talking about your Texas
roots. Mostly liquor stores?
Yes, mostly liquor stores. Here in Tennessee, you can't purchase liquor in a grocery store, so we're in liquor stores. Mm-hmm. We want to be a regional brand. We'll never make enough whiskey to say to blanket the country.
Sure.
And that's not my goal. We're using kind of old world techniques, very traditional equipment, things like that.
Did you make your own distillation pots?
No, we did not.
Uh-huh. Did you think about it?
No, and the reason is, it's like you want to leave some things to people are professionals in different trades. Uh-huh. So we actually went to Vendome Copper and Brass in Louisville, Kentucky. They've been building stills up there since about 1893. Them and Forsyth in Scotland are probably the two most well-known still manufacturers in the world. Mm-hmm. So we went to them and had something custom made for us that they hadn't done before. We use a pot still with a swan neck. Very
so real traditional.
Very traditional. Yeah. You know, it's talking about nuances. A pot still distillation versus a column still distillation is different. Is a different animal. So, you know, whiskey until about the mid to late 1800s had all been made going back to the 1500s on a pot still. In Scotland and Ireland, they use them there as well.
And it's interesting. I've been up in the Highlands.
Oh, nice.
And there'll be the swan neck.
Right.
You know, and there'll be some dent in it.
Yes.
And I go, why didn't you guys fix this? They go, don't touch it. They firmly believe that all these weird little defects and whatnot.
And distillers have those kind of superstitions. A lot of us look at stills kind of like a boat. You know, they have their own personalities and things. And a lot of times if you get a dent on your still, you have to buy another still about every 30 years or so. So a lot of them will ask the manufacturer to put that dent back in there. Like, they don't want to mess up anything as far as their production
in
goes.
That's literally,
that's very true. Yeah, I love you're right about that.
Yeah. So tell us about here. You have an on-site tasting.
Yep. So we're Leaper's Fort Distillery sits right outside the village of Leaper's Fort on South Hall Road.
Not too far from Nashville.
Not too far. We're from downtown Nashville proper. We're on a good day, about 40 minutes, something like that.
So probably a lot of day trippers come
out
here?
We do. We saw our first year, we saw 10,000 visitors our first year in 2019. You know, Corona got us this year. But we're seeing on average somewhere around 18,000 paid tours a year. And most of that traffic is coming out of Nashville as far as our tourism goes, you know, with everything going on in Nashville with the music scene. So,
and probably a lot of you walk away with a few bottles.
They
right?
do, yes. Our retail and tasting area is this cabin we're sitting in. It was originally built in 1820. Wow. We moved it actually from another small town in Tennessee and rebuilt it here. So we sit on close to 30 acres. So we're kind of a campus feel. Our still house is timber frame construction. Very old world construction. It's a neat place, you know, very aesthetically pleasing.
Very cool. Do you do events out here?
We do. They're kind of a distant memory now. Talking about 2020.
Back in the day.
Right, back in the day. Yeah. We used to do something called the Stillhouse Sessions. You know, us being in Middle Tennessee, and you've been doing this all day, you know, the Americana Music Triangle. Yeah. So anyway, we have access to some of the best musicians in the world, some of the best songwriters in the world, very famous folks in that industry. So we used to do a thing called the Stillhouse Sessions. It was very small and intimate. You usually have 75 to about 90 people. And it would be an acoustical show. And we did it in our stillhouse. And we literally transformed the stillhouse into a set.
With no amplification.
No. Well, actually, we did. We had a little amplification.
Little pickup.
Yes, and things like that. And usually we would invite 2 to 3 songwriters in. All these guys have number one hits. And George Strait and Waylon Jennings and the rest of them. So it's a good time. We look forward to kind of getting back on that train.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. I was just going to ask, when are we going to start up again?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hopefully, you know, we can get this behind us.
We talked about the variables are minimal.
Sure.
In your craft.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But you're trying to go for this end product with a specific palate taste. So tell us about what you're trying to impart to me.
One thing we do on our ingredients is we use a toasted malted barley versus a regular malted barley. So just by nature, that barley has given us some flavor out of the gate that is normally not there. We spend more money on our barley. We treat it as a flavoring grain as well as an enzyme grain. Another thing is we have a very low proof coming off our still. So we come off the still at about 137 proof. By federal law, we're making Tennessee whiskey or bourbon, you have to come off less than 160 proof. So the lower that proof is, the more flavor that's in that distillate or the whiskey. The other thing we're doing as a differentiation is by federal law, we have to put that whiskey in a new charred white oak barrel at no more than 125 proof. We go in at 110 proof, which means we actually buy more barrels. So watering that whiskey down a little more. And the reason we do that is for two reasons. Science has shown that you're getting the most use out of that barrel at 110 proof.
Interesting.
More extraction of vanillas, caramels. You're getting a balance between water-soluble sugars and alcohol-soluble sugars.
And it has to be a new oak?
A new oak. Yeah, that's an American law.
You can only use it once.
For Tennessee whiskey and bourbon, yeah. Rye whiskey, you can only use that barrel once. We'll sell that back to our barrel broker, and then they go to Scotland and Ireland.
Exactly. I was going to say,
exactly, right.
Scotland depends on you guys.
Yeah. They do. They do a lot for in Ireland as well.
Yeah.
The other reason is prior to Prohibition, that federal law was 110 proof. Mm-hmm. So it's more of a pre-Prohibition style. Very full-bodied whiskey, whereas we were talking about Scotland and Ireland. For us, the barrel is an ingredient. For bourbon and Tennessee whiskey, about 65% of the flavor profile is coming out of that barrel, where Scotland and Ireland are getting second-hand, third-hand, fourth-hand barrels. Mm-hmm. So they're more grain-forward than barrel-forward. You get those delicate grain notes. Also, you know, in barrel aging, you want a perfect marriage between the spirit and the barrel itself. So for most bourbons and Tennessee whiskey, that's not as long as a scotch is. Usually it's about 7 to 9 years if you ask the old guys in the industry. We know there's 23-year-old bourbons out there. Mm-hmm. They're a little woody. But anyway, where a scotch or an Irish, because of the potency has been taken out of the barrel, that perfect marriage point is kind of drug out and further in space, so they can let that whiskey sit.
Yeah, I'll take a 24-year Macallan any day.
Absolutely, yes.
Any day.
Beautiful whiskey.
Yeah. Let's talk for a moment. Are you okay on time?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Let's talk for a moment about the tasting experience.
Yes.
And I always joke and I tell people, I said, you know, they do not have whiskey tastings in Scotland. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
They have nosings.
Yes.
If you said you want to go to a tasting, they would go, what?
Yeah. Right.
So let's talk about the olfactory experience of a noble spirit that you're making, which is, I think, important for people to understand. That's what maximizes your savoring your whiskey.
And we do, at the end of our tours, we do a tasting here of our distillates or expressions that we produce. And as everyone knows, our olfactory sense is tied to our sense of taste. So they're intertwined. And really with whiskey, there's kind of three phases that we go through in a whiskey tasting. One is we look at color. You know, we're visually looking at that whiskey. We usually use a Glencairn glass, which is from Scotland, and it concentrates those vapors towards the mouth of the glass. So as you're nosing, you're getting more of a full-bodied experience, and your nose is preparing your palate for what's about to enter your mouth. And so we tell people that whiskey is a flammable consumable, which sounds crazy, but it really is. You know, it's a salt in your senses. So you can get things on the nose that you don't get on the palate. You're always going to get the caramels and the vanillas and things like that. There's some more obscure tasting notes you'll pick up. But it's really kind of setting the stage for what that whiskey is going to taste like on your palate. And we always tell people, your first sip should be small because it is an assault on your senses. Mm-hmm. You know, just enough to kind of coat your tongue. And then, you know, if you've got a half ounce pour, work your way through that slowly.
Yeah. Okay, one more. Talk to us about introduction of spring water.
Sure.
Yeah.
So back in the day, water was a bigger deal than it is now. The definition of mash water that we use is devoid of iron and high in calcium. So here in Middle Tennessee, our bedrock is all limestone. Kentucky is the same way. Areas in Texas are that way, limestone bedrock. So limestone is calcium. And as that water is passing through that limestone, it's filtering out any iron that's in the water and imparting calcium. So it was perfect. Same way in Scotland and Ireland. The old guys that came over here from those areas that knew how to distill back in the old country, they found the same water here that they had over there. So they're like, hey, we can use this water the same way we did back in the old country. If you were to go to Lower Alabama prior to water treatment, there's a lot of iron in the water down there. Iron actually reacts with the mash, turns it black. If you're trying to proof it, it turns it black. So water is a big deal.
Yeah. Yes, sir. All right. So anything else that you want to share closest to your heart?
You know, we feel fortunate to be where we're at in Leaper's Fork. This area has an emphasis on heritage tourism. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on here. Tourism has helped us sustain our business while we're aging whiskey. You know, little retail shop we have here and the tours we do and the tastings have helped us. This business is kind of like Christmas tree farm with a lot of overhead.
Right.
So, you know, we're growing trees, aging barrels. And so the tourism has really kind of helped us get over the hump. And we're finally over that as of now. But you know, we feel fortunate to be where we're at.
As a business owner, small business owner in a community, how many jobs are you responsible for creating?
Sure. So we are a small business and, you know, we're not a big boy. We employ about 12 people right now and that wouldn't have jobs ordinarily.
Yeah.
So we feel like we're a contributor in that aspect. And it feels good to manufacture a product. We were talking about you and your furniture that you're doing. It feels good to actually create something. And I feel like the people we have here, they're part of that process. And we treat them like family.
Yeah. Somebody can go, here, yes, I made this, and sure, hand them the product that you made. But
there's something gratifying about
it. Yeah,
that,
there is.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. And that could be a song as well.
Yeah, it could. Right. Mm-hmm. So, Lee, if somebody wanted to learn more about your world, where would you direct them?
Our website is leapersfortdistillery.com. Our LF Distillery on Instagram. And if you search Leapers Fork Distillery on Facebook, we're there. We're doing tours Tuesday through Sunday. Please, if you're coming to town, look at our website. We've got all the information on there. That's how you locate us. And my name is Lee Kennedy, and thank you for being at Leapers Fork Distillery. Tom, thank you.
Awesome. My pleasure. Great day in paradise. Thanks, Lee.
Yes, sir.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Tennessee. We'll see you here.
The Leapers Fork Distillery Show is the 10th in a multi-part series showcasing the Nashville's Big Backyard Economic Initiative, focused on rural destinations along the Natchez Trace National Parkway, from Leapers Fork near Nashville down the Trace to the Shoals region in northern Alabama.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.
Well, I'll be turning 33 next Friday morning. Friday morning 15 years ago, my grandfather called me to his bedside, and he told me there was something I should know. He said, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there are crying, the land will save you, wait and see. So I loaded up my car and moved to Denver. work a job and chase big city dreams. But I never found the life I really wanted till I came back home to Leaper's Fork, Tennessee. He said, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there crying, the land will save you, wait and see. It didn't hit me quite as hard then as those words come through today, but in the chaos all around me, I can still hear Grandpa say, don't stray too far from the land, boy. The land will one day set you free. When the cities all are dying, the folks up there are crying, the land will save you, wait and see.